Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. It's time for our dive into the news, which we do every couple of weeks. And with me, two men very disappointed that their voices didn't make the final cut of the new Band-Aid single. So Jim Reynolds, our head of national
ministry. How do you know my voice?
Well, I don't think you were ever asked to record on it, and it's a remake. John Stevens, our national director, is here as well.
Only one of us is actually a genuine bona fide recording artist.
Right.
And I'll let you think about which one
that is. We will think about that through the course of this podcast.
Band-Aid 1984. I was 17.
Yeah, there we are.
It was actually a seminal moment, I think, culturally and personally, actually an exposure of what was going on in Ethiopia. And actually, Band-Aid was a massive thing. I know there's some criticism of that now and people saying it sort of reflects a sort of an attitude toward Africa that's wrong, but it absolutely transformed people's thinking and the money that was raised. And I think Bob Geldof is an absolute hero for having done that.
Yes. And do you know why it says there won't be snow in Africa? It's because they couldn't make anything rhyme with Ethiopia. Or had too many syllables, I think.
At least he and Midge are like being honest about that.
That's very good.
I still like listening to it because you basically kind of guess all the voices and it's your kind of sort of...
Have you seen the new video, John?
I haven't.
You'd love it. Oh. You would love it.
I believe Dizzy Rascal's rap is still in there, which is excellent.
He wasn't there in 84.
I think he was born in 84. Anyway, very good. Brothers, let's talk a little bit about what's been going on in FIEC. We've got four conferences that bookings are open for.
This week.
I want to mention each of them in turn. Okay. So the first one we've done a little podcast on, which we'll put in the show notes, which is Journeys.
Yep.
So that's the remodeled hub conference, Journeys. That's coming up 24th to the 26th of January. Be great to book in for that if you're exploring ministry.
Yeah, that's right. And I think people who are listening to this podcast are probably not likely to be exploring ministry, but you'll know people in your church who are. Mm. So I think this is an opportunity for you as a leader to send someone along. It just helps to have some objective extra input into their stepping into ministry. It's also useful for them to have space and time to think about ministry. And we've subsidized it heavily this year, so it's cheap.
So come along to Journeys if you're in that position. Then we've got a conference coming up in the middle of February, which is Planters, which Graham Byrne and our head of local ministries is leading. That's for people who are planting churches, thinking about planting churches, involved in revitalizations. Chance to gather everybody together 12th to the 13th of February, which is a great opportunity to support church planting, John.
Absolutely. And we think that's a key part of strategy for reaching the nation with the gospel. We want to be independent churches working together to reach Britain for Christ. One of the things FIEC has always done is plant churches. And certainly coming out of COVID, there's an increased church planting. And we really want to encourage churches to be planting into communities that don't have gospel witness, communities that have little gospel witness, into different communities that aren't currently being reached. And there's lots of expertise, wisdom within the FIEC community that we want to draw on. So Graham's going to be bringing all of that together. We've already got some coaching for church planters. So we want to support church planters. We offer church plant recognition to new church plants that enables them to get some financial support, practical advice to get going. So we just want to harness all of that to encourage our churches to be effective in church planting.
Excellent. So go to the events page of the website to book on either Journeys or Planters, or indeed for Thrive and the Ministry Wives Retreat. So Thrive is our conference for women in ministry, women serving in pastoral ministry positions in churches. Then the Ministry Wives Retreat is the Ron Seal one. It's for ministry wives. So those who are serving in any type of ministry, if you're married to somebody serving in ministry, a ministry wife, please come along to the Ministry Wives Retreat.
And again, it's been worth saying, we've been so encouraged to see the growth of women's ministry and the numbers of people wanting to come to those conferences. So that has been a real investment we've wanted to make. Our women's ministry team has grown with Sean Robinson having joined that, looking after planters' wives. So this is, again, another key area of where we're wanting to strengthen and support gospel ministry.
So Thrive in the Ministry Wives Retreat takes place at the beginning or end, depending on which one you go to, 19th to the 23rd of May. So 5 days there. First 3 days is Thrive. Second 3 days is the Ministry Wives Retreat. So all of those can be found on the events page of the website, which we'll pop into the show notes. So that brings us up to date with what's going on in FIEC. Let's talk about what's happening in the news. Now, it's important to say we're recording this podcast before today's debate and vote in the Commons on the assisted suicide bill. And we don't know the outcome of that. So you'll be listening to this when the outcome will be known. I think the vote is early afternoon this afternoon. But what I wanted to do here was just talk a little bit about how this debate has happened over the past few weeks, heading for today's kind of Commons debate in terms of faith in the public square, how people have expressed their opinions, what that's looked like. It's been fascinating to me that Shabana Mahmood, who is a Muslim MP, has been criticised for bringing her Muslim faith into the argument, as it were. But isn't that what everybody's doing? Everyone's bringing
their position.
She's not
just an MP, of course. She's the Lord High Chief Justice, which sounds like
Chancellor.
Something... Is she?
Well, she's not the Chief Justice.
Is she not?
No, she's the Lord Chancellor.
Oh, okay. Lord High Chancellor.
Well, while you debate her position, let's think about the
Lord
principles.
High Chancellor. It still sounds like something from Gilbert and Sullivan. She's High something. Yeah, I know. I saw that in the title. Anyway, so she's a member of the cabinet. Is she a member of the cabinet?
She's a cabinet, but she's not a judge.
She's a cabinet, but she's not a judge. There you go.
Excellent.
I didn't think she was a judge. I just got the title wrong. Yeah. There we are.
But the point is, everyone's bringing their particular viewpoints into the debate, whether they're Christian, Muslim, non-Christian, atheist, whatever it is.
There is either a faith position or a non-faith position, and that somehow a non-faith position carries more weight because it's a non-faith position. So that's the argument of Lord Falconer, who had introduced a bill into the House of Lords, but removed that in favour of this one. And he's a great proponent of an assisted dying legislation. And I think it's just naive for him to think and basically say in the public square, my view is more valid because it's not a faith position, because every position at some level comes from a worldview.
Yes.
And is born out of a worldview. And I don't think that makes his position any more legitimate than others. But I mean, we hear that constantly, don't we, in all kinds of different places. The secular society are often saying things like that. But no position is neutral. Mm. It comes from a worldview, doesn't it? Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that criticism of religious views, that came from the British humanists as well, who pointed out that a couple of organisations that have been campaigning weren't overt about their Christian kind of background, and then they criticised that. So why should you listen to doctors who are speaking who come from a religious perspective? So there is, on the part of some, a suspicion of religion being brought into the public sphere. But of course, that's with a loaded purpose. It's not as if that's a neutral comment either. But I think this whole debate does actually open up the question of where do people get their authority from? How do they make their decisions? Because there are a number of things that are factoring into why people might decide what MPs might take into account. So at one level, do they listen to public opinion? So the surveys seem to have suggested that there's a much stronger public support for assisted dying than maybe in the past. So does the democratic view, is that what makes people make their decision? Is it religious faith or another ideology that people have? So at one level, for those who are saying this is a matter of choice, that's actually an ideology. You can't say that that is somehow some pure reason position. That is a faith position that people have reached. That is a good thing. And at one level, that ideology flows over. Do we listen to experts? So there are doctors and people working in the area of palliative care who are sharing their experiences. Now, there are doctors on both sides, but do the expert voices count? Is it some reasoned kind of argument from sort of principles of logic? It raises the whole question of how we make moral decisions and what authority sources play into that. And again, there's an assumption that some are neutral and some aren't. Mm. Whereas all in effect reflect some kind of ideological commitment that influences what people think.
Okay. And there's the stories actually in the authority with the, I think the greatest power are personal stories.
Mm. And they've been used on both sides.
They've been used on both sides, but especially on the assisted dying pro side. Mm. Because it's, you know, this was my loved one. This was my spouse. This was my parent. This is me. And this is the situation I'm in.
And they are heartbreaking.
They are heartbreaking. Yeah. But it is interesting, isn't it, how many of the news stories and the web articles basically begin with a story of someone. And of course, at that point, it's very difficult to make objective arguments because it feels very personal. Mm. So I think we've got to be careful about using stories like that in all kinds of different arguments, because one person is one person and doesn't necessarily mean that the legislation needs to be changed.
And I think we mustn't buy into the idea that somehow a faith argument is inconsistent with reason. People often think that, you know, faith is somehow a position that isn't reasoned and is irrational and nobody could hold it. Actually, people might hold their beliefs about assisted dying because they've got strong religious convictions about the value of life, but that can be bound up with kind of reasoned arguments about life and its significance, and reasoned arguments about therefore how people should be treated in society, reasoned arguments about what the implications would be of introducing this particular change or not. So faith is not disconnected from reason and necessarily in contrast with it. And we think about that about Christian faith. We believe that believing in the Bible, believing in Jesus is an act of ultimately faith and trust. But that doesn't mean to say it's an irrational leap into the dark in which there is no kind of rational element to that, no evidence on which a judgment can sort of be based.
How do we get that balance right, though? I'm interested to know what you think about this, John. So if I'm writing to our MP, who looks like he's going to vote against the legislation as it happens, but if I'm writing to our MP, do I just make arguments that are stripped of faith? So, you know, there are some good arguments that are nothing to do with faith. They're about the amount of scrutiny the bill has received and will receive.
Not enough safeguards.
Not enough safeguards. Yeah, yeah. You know, there are what's happening in other countries. So there are some very strong arguments that are just neutral arguments when it comes to faith. But I have strong views when it comes to faith. So with this issue and others, how much should we engage in the public debate and allow our faith to come into it? I guess, you know, one of the things that's happening with Shabana Mahmood and Lord Falconer is that Christians might think, well, I better not mention my faith at all then. I'll just make the rational arguments rather than letting my faith come forward. We want both, don't we?
I think that's a great question. And that's a combination of, in a sense, part of our confession of our faith, but also on some of these issues, we need to engage in co-belligerence with others. And we're seeking to persuade people to adopt a position if they don't have
our faith. I mean, let's be clear, if the bill does fail because of a technicality, I'm going to be rejoicing in that.
Yeah. But, you know, in a way, Christian faith is not the same as Shabana Mahmood's faith.
No.
So, you know, faith is not this unitary thing. There are different reasons, and that faith has a different shape to it in various ways. So actually, we are, if we want to win an argument like this in a plural culture, you inevitably need to win over people who hold different faith positions and people who are coming from a what they would say is a non-faith position. So you have to do two things. There's a witnessing to what we believe and why we believe it, but there's also an arguing with others who don't share our premises in order to bring about a good outcome. So I mean, when I wrote to our MP, I said, I'm a Christian. I hold this view as a Christian. But here, I think, are the reasons why this is a right and proper position, that even if you're not a Christian, this ought to be a matter of concern because of these implications for society. And I think that was an attempt to both point out where I stood myself, but also to make those arguments. Now, actually, that's because I've developed a personal relationship with him, and he knows who I am, and he knows I'm a Christian. So in some sense, it's much easier to do that when you have real relationships and the explaining about a particular area is in the context of known faith and known Christian commitment. I think that's why it's so important Christians in the workplace or whatever are absolutely open about the fact that they are Christians. Because then, in a sense, everything that you say is put in the context of, in some sense, connected with your Christian faith. So in personal relationship, it's somewhat easier. In public debate, the question is this the primary act of the purpose of something, this act of communication? Is it primarily evangelism, confessing Christ, or is it about trying to do winning over and persuading of an argument? And then that's got to be worked through.
Can I ask you both, if this bill passes today, we don't know at the moment, as I've said, and if assisted suicide is brought into law, people can access this through the National Health Service. How do we respond to that as Christians? Because they could be real questions by this coming Sunday.
And that's a difficult, so a whole package of things. That first of all, even if this passes, that doesn't mean it will become law. So this is the first passage of a kind of private member's bill. Yeah. It would show that the MPs are wanting to go in that direction. We have a system in which the House of Lords exercises scrutiny. There would be considerable debate about the nature and shape of a bill that would come afterwards. So we mustn't think that whatever happens today, that is necessarily the end of the story. By the end of the process, Parliament may choose to legislate to allow some kind of assisted dying. At that point, I think there's nothing we can do to stop that being brought into effect. We want to keep criticising it. We want to sort of keep making clear deficiencies, guard against the slippery slope and how that would inevitably unfold. No doubt there will be then stories to be told down the line of how this is working in practice. Perhaps most of all, we need to redouble our efforts for caring for those who are sick and who are dying.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually to model the different way.
Yeah.
So at one level, we can criticise, but if we ourselves in our communities are not modelling the kind of loving care for people sort of end-of-life situations and with conditions that make them think life is not worth living, then actually the world will not look at us. So in a sense, if the majority in Parliament decides to adopt this, at one level, it will become part of the practice of our community. That doesn't mean we accept it and think that it's right. But I think we also need to make sure that we are modelling what we think is the better way.
So there are other things in that category, aren't there? For example, the way that Christians and churches provide help in terms of unwanted pregnancy. Mm. So we lament and abhor the Abortion Act and the effect that it's had. It doesn't look like that's going to change anytime soon, though we pray and wish it did. But actually, there are better things that Christians can do and better models that Christians can show.
Mm. So, I mean, again, in the UK at the moment, palliative care is woofully underfunded.
Yeah. And that's been one of the big arguments, actually, hasn't it, during the debate?
Yeah. Christians have been at the forefront of developing that. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm thinking, do Christians give to, say, hospices to enable that to be provided? And, you know, do churches support that work in quite the way? And again, we might not see it as direct evangelism or whatever, but those are ways in which we can signal, perhaps, our support for a different way and what we think is a better way.
What he said.
We wait to see which way the vote goes this afternoon. Let's move on to another story. A couple of weeks ago, we spoke about the Makin report into the abuse of John Smythe. We touched on
by
that.
By John Smythe,
Sorry, yes, yeah. By John Smythe, I beg your pardon. I think it's worth us reflecting a couple of weeks on. I want to ask the question, could this happen in our churches? And how do we prevent it?
I think the answer to that is yes and no. It's a slightly more nuanced question, just saying yes, it could, no, it couldn't. The report is very harrowing, and John Smythe was a criminal abuser. Can such people be in churches and active and grooming and doing all the things they want to do to perpetuate their abuse?
Yes, they can.
Yes, they can. Yeah. And that goes deep into our roots of you know, what we believe theologically about human nature and the effect of sin. So I think we need to, and that should make us, that answer, yes, that could happen. Yes, that sort of person could exist and possibly does in and around our circles, should make us be very, very careful about our safeguarding. Safeguarding is different now from what it was when John Smythe was abusing people. Mm. So I think, could there be a cover-up in the way that there was then? Part of the answer to that is, if people are following safeguarding procedures, I think no, if they've got good safeguarding procedures, but obviously not every organization and church does. So it's a slightly nuanced answer. It does reinforce, I think, that actually the safeguarding culture has changed, and that's really good news. Church leaders, you know, you sometimes hear church leaders who talk about safeguarding in the same way that people sometimes talk about health and safety. Oh, safeguarding, you know. Mm. And I think that's, I find that quite abhorrent, actually, when people speak like that. It's right and proper for churches to take care of people. Mm. So having good and robust and regularly reviewed safeguarding policies should mean that if there are such people, and hope that that doesn't happen, but something does happen in a church situation, if it's reported, if it's discovered, it's quickly and properly and appropriately dealt with.
John?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, the report reveals, the psychology report reveals, and John Smythe was ultimately a sexually motivated, sadistic predator on young men. And so there are predators like that in all walks of life, and they are very skilled and adept at putting themselves in positions where they have opportunities to abuse. They're very convincing, they're very compelling, they speak the language, they adopt it. Psychologist basically doesn't really know whether John Smythe believed what he thought he believed, or was he, in a sense, using this as an opportunity to be able to abuse people. So the Bible talks of wolves in sheep's clothing, and we need to remember they're in sheep's clothing. Actually are very persuasive. Mm. They look like everybody else. Actually, it's only when their wolfish behavior begins to emerge. So I think people can say, could you have stopped them? Well, the answer is, for much of the time, they look like sheep. And in this review process, I mean, obviously, it primarily was focusing on the failure to deal with the abuser and the care for the victims when the abuse emerged. What it doesn't quite answer is, along the way, what was the first point at which anybody could have spotted that John Smythe was abusing in this kind of way? Because actually, it came out when victims began to talk about what was happening. He was acting secretively. It was happening in private, in his own home, as he was bringing people back. It was in a culture of secrecy, which is what abusers create that prevent people speaking. So at one level, yes, it could happen in any church, any organization, any institution, basically because predatory abusers like that are very clever and they operate in that way.
Yeah. It's worth saying that this didn't happen in a church.
Yeah.
There was a Church of England report and there is some connection with the Church of England. He was a licensed lay reader, but actually it didn't happen in a church. And I think actually a lot of FIUC church leaders will be involved in other Christian organisations, maybe with camps, which is a sort of direct parallel to this situation, maybe with another parachurch organisation that's providing a certain service in a certain area, putting on conferences, providing training, and not all working with children, some working with adults. But I think churches do think about safeguarding if they should be. I think organisations are slightly behind the curve. I mean, organisations that work with children are probably well advanced in this, but other organisations perhaps haven't thought about it as much. So, for example, if someone came to the FIC Leaders Conference and they had a complaint about behaviour, would they know what to do with it? Well, actually, if they looked on the website, they would find what to do with it. Are we clear enough about that? I don't know. It's a question for us. So I think organisations that put on events for others, especially, or serve others, do need to be thinking about this themselves. It's a broader question than just a church question. And because lots of our leaders are involved in those organisations, should be on their agenda too.
I think one thing we've got to be just particularly careful of is intense individual private ministry.
Yes.
I think that's something that is a feature. That is a context in which abusers have opportunity. So John Smythe, to some extent, Jonathan Fletcher, some of these other abuse cases that have been picked up on, it occurred in the context of not church, not kind of youth group activities, but actually in private ministry to individuals, where individuals were brought in and given a special place and special treatment and invested in with the great leader. And I think that individual intensity and privacy of ministry is just a particular context. And it's become a pattern for ministry. It's actually not a particularly biblical pattern for ministry. If you look at the New Testament, the pattern for ministry is primarily the community life of the local church, what we might call the ordinary means of grace, the gathering together to share the Lord's Supper, to hear the word taught, to build one another up, ministry in the family. This kind of individual intensity of one-on-one ministry, it doesn't look a particularly biblical pattern of how ministry was to be done. Most ministry is done in groups, not necessarily in that sort of very intense kind of way. And I think there are just potential dangers with that, where there are significant imbalances, a danger of a sort of a hero worship. I also think something that's really important in ministry is danger signs are anybody who is suggesting a practice privately that they're not preaching publicly. So what was happening in some of those kind of situations was somebody was basically inducting people into a form of ministry and an activity that they were advocating as being biblical and good, but it wasn't what they were preaching on a Sunday. It wasn't what they were doing in public. They weren't standing up and saying, this is the kind of ministry we need to have in our life and churches. And I think that secrecy of introducing something that is not part of the public ministry teaching an example that somebody is setting is a danger sign that we should be very aware of.
It's like a form of Gnosticism.
Well, it is, yeah. But so saying to people privately, I mean, essentially an element of beating in both of those things. Yeah. Nobody was standing up in churches advocating and preaching that is what should be done to help people in their spiritual lives. And then that is done in a private context. So be on guard against anybody who is not publicly speaking of the things that they are wanting to do and saying that they should do.
Now, as the policy guy, let me end this little section by saying, you know, every year we ask our churches to perform a review of their safeguarding procedures, and churches and organisations need to be constantly reflecting on, updating and improving their safeguarding policy. So that will be my big message. And we'll put links in the show notes to people who can help you do that. So 318 Christian Safeguarding Services. Our own Becky Thomas can give some pointers in the right directions on that in terms of safeguarding policy. Yeah. So do make use of the professional
folk out there.
It is not a tick box. No. It is vital. And I would encourage you to lean into that if you're not doing already or you need to do more. Let's move on to another story, brothers. So this has happened overnight. So the Transport Secretary has resigned. Louise Hay.
Unlike the 4:33 from Paddington, which rarely seems to depart on time.
Very, very good. He's been storing that one up, I think.
But I just thought of that on the spur of the moment.
Well done,
funny
brother.
Guy.
Excellent. But interesting that her resignation has come because of a criminal offence committed several years ago, which really, having read into it, wasn't really her fault. So she was mugged in London. She gave the police a list of the things she thought had been stolen. Terrified as a young woman in London, she thought one of the things that had been stolen was her mobile phone, work one. Turns out that was at home, and then she switched it on. This alerted the police, and charges followed. There's some questions here, aren't there, about, it seems Sir Keir Starmer knew about this.
So the story is slightly more complicated than that. So she did commit a criminal offence. So she was interviewed about it and she refused to comment.
Oh, she said she regretted didn't she? Yes, thank you.
She said her lawyer told her to not make it.
She regretted saying a no comment interview. That's true.
She also apologised because she obviously found the phone, kept it, used it, and didn't kind of inform her employer of it.
So am I being too kind to her? Is that what you're saying?
Well, we don't know the full circumstances, and it just seems quite difficult that police have clearly chosen to prosecute something as a sort of some kind of offence of dishonesty.
It crossed a threshold.
And actually, at one level, I don't think we fully know. So there is something that meant that people thought it was absolutely necessary for this to be brought to a kind of a magistrate's court. And of course, you then gain a criminal record for some kind of offensive dishonesty. So I think we don't know.
No.
So Keir Starmer did know, though, and still appointed her.
She disclosed it to him when she was, and we don't know quite what she disclosed, but she disclosed criminal conviction when she was appointed to the shadow cabinet. And this is, we ought to be clear, this all happened a long time ago. She was a very young member of parliament. She was elected, I think she was age 29. This happened when she was 26 or 27.
24, I think.
Or even younger than that. And she's now in her late 30s. So this happened a long time ago. So Keir Starmer knew about it, didn't think that disqualified her from serving either in the shadow cabinet or, one must assume, in the cabinet, because he still knew about it when he appointed her to the cabinet. But obviously it's come out into the public, and she stepped down very quickly as a result of that. And I think the questions for me on this issue are just interesting around, to what extent does that actually disqualify her, a past criminal conviction? Does it disqualify her? I mean, she was open about it to Keir Starmer. Was it a disqualifying offence? And B, if it was, does it have a term on it? To what extent does a disqualifying offence stop being a disqualifying offence if it's historic?
So her conviction's spent now, for example.
So I think that raises interesting questions for church leadership. There are questions about when things become disqualifying. We might have very obvious things that we think, well, they're definitely disqualifying, but there are grey areas. Who determines what those grey areas are in church life? And to what extent do those offences become spent effectively? If someone says to you, oh, I, did something when I was 18, you're thinking about them as an elder, does that mean they can serve as an elder now? Who makes those decisions? And I think those are quite difficult questions. And we've seen some high profile cases, especially in the States, of fallen leaders who have just restored themselves and have gone on and started serving in other cases. And I think we'd want to say something very uncomfortable about that, if not clearly wrong about that. But these do feel like quite grey areas. It doesn't always seem it's right and wrong. It feels like it falls into the category of wisdom. And I think those are difficult things to judge on.
I think that's right. And even in this case, there's a difference between disqualification, which means you couldn't ever exercise that sort of office, and what might be described as a loss of credibility, which means that you're not really able to effectively function. So Keir Starmer's letter to her says you've got a great future ahead of you. There is an implication that this is not something that would perhaps disqualify her from serving in office in the future. As we say, it was when she was young. There are plenty of MPs who've been convicted of various things who have gone on to serve in different roles. I think what's made her credibility difficult here is that even though it was disclosed to Keir Starmer, it wasn't disclosed more publicly, so it wasn't made more widely known. And at various points, she's done things like she's accused others and criticise them for their criminality, so Boris Johnson and people caught up in the COVID. So that then just attracts the criticism of hypocrisy, that you are basically denouncing others in a political sphere, whereas actually you've got this own past that people are not known of. I think there's for some things in the past, it doesn't disqualify, but if it's kept hidden, then actually inevitably it undermines credibility if in some way or other that comes out, that there is an honesty that needs to, in a sense, establish the person's credibility. So that when they're speaking about other things, they're actually able to say, not I'm criticising you because I'm squeaky clean, but I recognise this is wrong because I myself am in that position. In some ways, that's exactly the way that Christians talk to other people who are sinners. We speak as sinners to sort of sinners. So I think you're right that there are some things that might be disqualifying, and it's a difficult line, but there might be other things that actually just mean that for a time our credibility and ability to function has been compromised and needs to be regained by an openness and honesty.
I'm not quite sure where that line is drawn though, John. So for example, if I was an elder interviewing someone for a pastor at our church, you know, any town evangelical church, and they said to me, "Oh, you know, I'm 40, but you need to know about this thing that happened when I was 18." And we as elders, let's say, decide that's okay. Does all the church need to know about that offence when someone was 18, or that sin when someone was 18? So, that's the parallel.
It is a good parallel, isn't it?
Because that's exactly what this is.
It wasn't disclosed
more widely. Yeah.
I remember for some things being asked the question in an interview, is there anything else that might come out that could discredit the gospel if it were known? And the answer is, actually, maybe in that situation, somebody has to make the judgment for you. But I think there are some things that if people discover it from the past, it will inevitably have the implication of discrediting what you're doing
in
now.
The present, yeah.
So I think it's a really difficult judgment to be made. And of course, there are some things that if you'd been a minister and you did might have been disqualifying, but because you weren't a Christian at that point or you were a young Christian, again, that's not quite in the same category.
No, that's right.
Sort of either. So it's more a question of how you manage the openness, who needs to be known, how honest you need to be, and why something is being, in a sense, not known. What's the motivation for that as well?
So like a lot of these things, they are wisdom calls, aren't they, that churches and elders need to think through.
Ask for help.
Yeah.
If you're not sure, ask for help. Mm.
So wasn't there an MP recently, or is it somebody else who kind of was disclosed that had some, it's the Reform MP, isn't it, who was disclosed to have some conviction for having sort of assaulted his wife domestic abuse. And again, there's another situation of there's something else in the past that wasn't made known, wasn't disclosed. Mm. Inevitably, it kind of affects, that might be in a slightly different category, people might think. So I think this is an important principle. Yeah.
Mm. We've mentioned his name in dispatches. Let's finish by talking about Boris Johnson.
Oh, can we?
So this is extraordinary. So Boris Johnson, doing an interview this week, has blamed the church.
Has he been out of the news? Has he wanted to get back in the news?
He's blamed the church for the obesity crisis.
More specifically, the Church of England.
I thought I'd broaden it. So
not the Catholic Church that he's joined.
So he said there's a spiritual void in the nation and people are gorging themselves on food. And
I think this has been helpful for me because I thought it was the maybe the fast food industry, or the chocolate making industry,
yeah,
the way that everything's laced, or the supermarkets placing things and putting them on offer. So to hear that it's the church's fault,
ultra processed foods crisis, are no longer to blame,
because I think we haven't got enough put on our shoulders already. So to have that, you know, let's bring it on, I say.
You think there's a really serious point though here, John?
He's been widely pilloried for this sort of statement. After all, Boris Johnson himself, as we know, publicly struggled with his weight and issues. And at one level, he is absolutely right that there is a spiritual void in our nation at the moment. And lots of the social issues that are being struggled with are actually to do with people's questions of existential meaning and significance. What reasons do people have for any kind of self-restraint? So
of things would be better in the country if people were Christians.
Absolutely. And so at one level, he is right that there is a spiritual vacuum that is leading to an awful lot of what is happening in society. And actually, one of the things that's encouraging us in churches is more people do seem to be coming to church, more people do seem to be becoming Christians. And I think mental health crises, some of these sort of issues and anxieties, actually the gospel does bring real hope, and people are looking for genuine, significant meaning. Postmodernism means people bear the burden of having to kind of invent themselves, have their own meaning. That is a crushing weight to live under. He's also right that the church, large sections of the church, have simply failed to make that the focus of their ministry. Mm-hmm. That in the end, in public sermons of bishops, Christmas messages and New Year's messages that are given, thought for the day, often what you hear in a kind of a church or on a kind of Radio 4 service, it is not addressing the spiritual needs of people as if that is the greatest concern of the church. Very often, it's political comment or social comment on a whole variety of issues and about seeking to kind of help people and argue that life should be done differently, but not actually addressing the real significance of who we are as human beings. Why do we have a spiritual problem? Mm. How is Jesus the answer to that? So there is an irony that I think he is right in identifying a spiritual need, and he's right that the church has often failed in that. Mm. I don't think that links to necessarily the obesity crisis, because again, that would only be the case if people actually believed it and knew the transforming power of the gospel to be able to resist. But I think there is something in what he says that as Christians, we ought to say, yes, that is a reminder to us of what the need is and what our mission is, and not to become distracted from it.
That's very generous. Boris Johnson's autobiography, available now, his memoirs from all good bookshops.
I didn't say he necessarily knew that he was saying that, but I do think from a Christian perspective, there is just that there is an inkling of something there that we ought to take notice of.
Well, we need to finish there, brothers. Time has gone and there's a 2-for-1 on mince pies at the supermarket. Want to go and take advantage of. I joke. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Independence, the FYEC podcast, as we've looked at some of the new stories that have been dominating the headlines this past couple of weeks. We hope you find it helpful. Do rate, leave a review so others can find it. And we'll look forward to speaking to you again for probably what will be a Christmas special in a couple of weeks'
time. Great.